I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. My guest today is Dr. Ibram X. Kendi, the founding director of the Anti-Racist Research and Policy Center at American University and the author of the new book, How to Be an Anti-Racist. In this follow-up to Stamped from the Beginning, his award-winning book about the origin of racist ideas, Dr. Kendi's latest offering is a pragmatic and instructive guide to fighting the roots of racism. He observes that if we focus only on racial discrimination, we lose sight of the central agents of bigotry, racist policy, and racist power. How can we reorient the conversation about racism in a way that will help dismantle it? Dr. Ibram Kendi joins me when Midday gets underway, right after these headlines. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Hope you had a nice Labor Day weekend. Today, a conversation about racism with Dr. Ibram X. Kendi, who has produced some of the most original and thoughtful scholarship on the history of racism and the rhetoric we employ to talk about race. His last book, published in 2016, is called Stamped from the Beginning: The Definitive History of Racist Ideas in America. It won the National Book Award for Nonfiction. His new book is called How to Be an Anti-Racist, in which he continues his exploration of what being a racist means, both historically and in the present moment. And he offers a guide to reorient our understanding of racism and how we might most effectively dismantle it. Dr. Kendi is the founding director of the Anti-Racist Research and Policy Center at American University and a columnist at The Atlantic. He'll be talking about his book tomorrow night at Johns Hopkins University. You are welcome to be part of our conversation with Ibram X. Kendi today. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet as well, @midday_WYPR. Dr. Kendi, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's great to be on the show.
Your book is provocative, compelling, and beautifully argued. So thank you very much for it. I really enjoyed reading it. You say that the opposite of racist isn't not racist. It's anti-racist. So what's the difference?
Well, I think first and foremost, in researching the history of people who in my previous book are identified as racist, typically these people, whether slave traders, whether enslavers, Jim Crow segregationists, or even white nationalists, typically self-identified as not racist. Just as many, I think, well-meaning Americans today who oppose these people also self-identify as not racist. And historically, I found that the term not racist has really not had any meaning other than to respond in that way when charged with being racist. I mean, we know the American saying, I'm not racist, no matter what someone has just said or did. But anti-racist actually has a clear meaning, and it has a clear meaning that is the opposite of racist, and I tried to sort of lay out those two meanings in the book.
You also, speaking of white nationalists, quote, of all people, Richard Spencer, who is a white nationalist, to say that racist is not a pejorative. It's not the worst word in the English language. It's not even the equivalent of a slur. Do you believe that?
Yeah, I think one of the things I think so many Americans who oppose white nationalists, I think, don't realize just how pervasive and prevalent white nationalist thought is. And one of their most prevailing ideas is that the term racist is an attack. It's a slur. It's a pejorative, which then causes people to not be introspective, which then causes people to just attack back, which then causes the polarization that we're seeing in our society. But I argue that no, racist is a descriptive term. It just describes when a person is saying that there's something wrong with a particular racial group or supporting a policy that is creating racial inequity.
You say that there's good news, which is that racist and anti-racist are not fixed identities, and that each of us can be racist one minute and anti-racist the next. Some people refer to the notion of implicit bias that people admit to having, or, you know, in best case scenarios, are at least aware of, even in people who otherwise, you know, certainly don't think of themselves as racist and, in fact, would embrace the notion of anti-racism. Is implicit bias the same thing as what you're talking about here?
I think it's a little bit different. And so in my work, I try to think through how people came to be biased, right? And typically people are biased because they've been trained and they have been, in a way, consumed ideas that cause them to think a particular group is lazy, or to be biased towards another group. And so really, that's really what my work is seeking to do. And it is, in fact, the case that if we're defining racist as a descriptive term that is describing what a person is doing in the moment, we also know that people change from moment to moment, from day to day, from issue to issue. And I think that's more reflective on how complex humans are and how humans have the capacity to change.
Yeah, this certainly is a complex notion, as your first book and this book as well, well, your second book, I guess, Stamped from the Beginning, and this new one make very clear. You talk about assimilationism. And you say that assimilationist ideas are racist ideas because it sets white people as the superior standard. So what is the alternative to that then? And how do you parse the differences?
Well, yes, I try to sort of distinguish in my work between segregationist ideas, which typically state that there is a racial biological hierarchy, meaning that certain racial groups are genetically distinct and superior or inferior to another. And then assimilationist ideas, which connote that certain racial groups are either culturally or behaviorally inferior, meaning their inferiority is not permanent, because if it was genetic, it would be permanent, meaning we have the capacity to civilize, or in this case, assimilate these people. And typically, when people think about civilizing or assimilating people, they standardize their way of life and then essentially try to get those other people to reach their standard. But the fact of the matter is, about this country and about the world, is there are so many different cultures, and we should be assessing and measuring every culture from its own cultural standard.
And in that regard, and I found this one of the most interesting parts of the book, is there a black culture, a white culture, and you know, Hispanic, Latinx culture, a gay culture, a women culture? I mean, are there separate cultures that are easily distinguishable and easily understood in order to be appreciated? And are the standards of those cultures often vastly different?
So I think this is where it gets very tricky, because I do think there's a such thing as African-American culture. I grew up, for instance, in the black church where, you know, the preacher would have, in a way, a conversation with the congregation during his or her sermon, in which he would say something and the congregation would say something back. And that wouldn't necessarily happen in other churches. So that's a demonstration of cultural difference. But I think where we get caught up is we don't realize that there's a such thing as cultural difference and behavioral sameness. And what I mean by that is every racial group, every cultural group loves, hates, smart, laziness, but all of these different behaviors show themselves differently in different cultures. And I think that's how we sort of have to understand the difference between behavior, which is something that humans do, and culture, which is something that groups do.
Yeah, that really is a fascinating aspect of this work. And you also say that if we focus on racial discrimination, which has long been the focus of many people who work to rid the world of racism, you're saying that that's taking our eye off the central tenet, the central agents of racism. What are those central agents, and how is a focus on racial discrimination per se deleterious to that, to our understanding?
So I think this is deeply complex. but I think our focus when we're thinking about policy, when we're thinking about how to carry out policy, should be on the goal should be racial equity. And so how we're carrying out a policy should be secondary to whether that policy and how it's being carried out is bringing equity. To give an example, some people consider affirmative action to be a form of racial discrimination, or what they call reverse discrimination. But when you look at the effects of affirmative action policy, it actually reduced racial inequity and created levels of racial equity. And so I think for me, the focus should be on policy. Are policies creating racial equity? And then policymakers, are people in positions of power, are they using their power to make policies that create racial equity?
And creating racial equity doesn't, and obviously that's a standard to which we can only aspire at this moment, because I don't think anybody would assert that we've achieved racial equity, although people do assert, well, it's certainly a lot better than it was, you know, in the 1950s or the 1970s. But you quote W.E.B. Du Bois, who says, "An American, a Negro, is two souls, two thoughts, two unreconciled strivings, two warring ideals in one dark body." How do you reconcile the duality of an African American's navigation through the world in which it is not equal?
Well, I think what Du Bois was in a way speaking to was sort of somewhat similar to what we as a nation sort of debated and experienced earlier in the summer, when four congresswomen of color who were U.S. citizens, three of whom were born in the United States, were told to go back to their country. And so it caused people of color, and it has caused people of color historically, who clearly were born in this country, to question whether they are an American, because other Americans were telling them that to be an American, you have to be white. And so they looked in the mirror and said, obviously, I'm not white, and I actually like my culture. I actually like African-American culture. But then again, I do want to be an American. And so that then creates this sort of inner strife that Du Bois spoke about. And I tried to sort of deal with that a little bit in the book.
You also write that you, like myself, thought only white people could be racist, and that black people couldn't be racist because black people didn't have the power to be racist. But you no longer believe that. Why not? So there is a thing. The existence of black racism exists. It's not just a matter of white racism. Is that right?
Well, what I realized specifically in writing my last book, Stamped from the Beginning, was first and foremost the effects of racist ideas, of anti-black racist ideas, and the effects of those anti-black racist ideas on the mind, no matter whether it's a white mind, Latinx mind, or even black mind, is it causes those people to see the problem as black people, to see the racial problem as black people, as opposed to racist policies. And so they don't challenge racist policies, which then allow those policies to persist. And anyone who is not challenging racist policies as an anti-racist is being racist. I think that's one side. The other side is that when you look at black people as a collective group, black people collectively do not have the power in this country to shape policy, to manage policy. But certainly black people have the power as a collective group to resist policy, which black people have historically done. But then when you look at black individuals, there actually are individuals in this country who have the power to shape policy. And the question is, are they using their individual power to support policies that create racial equity or inequity? And when they're using that power to push policies that create racial inequity, they're being a racist.
I do want to pick up on that after we take a quick break. Dr. Ibram X. Kendi is the founding director of the Anti-Racist Research and Policy Center at American University. He's also a columnist at The Atlantic. His new book is called How to Be an Anti-Racist. We'll have more with Dr. Kendi after a quick break. You are welcome to join our conversation at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us at @midday WYPR. Before we go to a break, a word about a story that we are keeping an eye on and which we will be exploring in depth in just a couple of weeks. If you are a reader of the Baltimore Sun, you may have noticed that as of yesterday, many stories don't include a byline by individual reporters, but rather writers are identified only as Baltimore Sun staff. This is because members of the Washington Baltimore Newspaper Guild, the union that represents reporters and other staffers at the Sun, are holding a byline strike this week. Negotiations for a new contract between the Guild and the parent company of the Sun, Tribune Publishing, began last month. The two sides are scheduled to meet again next Tuesday and again on September 17th. We have invited members of the Guild and management to join me here on Midday on September 24th to discuss their negotiations. The company made a contract offer to the Guild last month. Yesterday, the Guild issued a statement that characterized Tribune's contract offer as devastating and unsustainable. The statement went on to say, quote, "The Baltimore Sun Guild will be withholding our bylines for a week ending September 9th to demonstrate what is at stake. When you see an article or photo without a byline this week, imagine what our daily newspaper would look like without these stories." So certainly listeners to this program certainly know how much we rely on the fine reporting and analysis of Baltimore Sun journalists. Any disruption to that reporting would have terrible implications for our city and for our citizenry. So we'll keep you posted as to the status of the talks between the Guild and Tribune. And as I mentioned, we will have a thorough discussion of the issues after the two sides meet later this month. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, a conversation with Tim Alberta, the chief political correspondent for Politico magazine. He's written a terrific book about the recent history of the Republican Party and how it's wrestled with all manner of ideological and strategic disagreements ever since the presidency of George W. Bush. It's called American Carnage on the Front Lines of the Republican Civil War and the Rise of President Trump. As the presidential campaign season gets into high gear, Tim Alberta joins me for the hour tomorrow on Midday. If you're just joining us today, my guest today is Dr. Ibram X. Kendi, the founding director of the Anti-Racist Research and Policy Center at American University and a columnist at The Atlantic. In his latest book, How to Be an Anti-Racist, Dr. Kendi dismisses the cipher of non-racist declarations as an insufficient counter to systemic racial injustice and inequity. Rather, he asserts that anti-racist action is the only remedy for what he describes as one of the fastest spreading and most fatal cancers humanity has ever known. Ibram Kendi joins us from the studio of NPR in Washington, D.C., and you are welcome to join us as well at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle is @MiddayWYPR, and to follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWYPR. Dr. Kendi, I want to pick up on something we touched on a little bit just before the break, and that is this notion of internalized racist ideas that African Americans have to wrestle with, and also the importance of the rhetoric around our discussion of racism and racist ideas. You've talked about racist policies being a more tangible and exacting term of art, as opposed to what some people call institutional racism or structural racism, systemic racism. Can we dig a little deeper into that? Why do you think those terms are insufficient?
Well, I've had the ability to spend several years now speaking on racism around the country. And really my first language, my first vocabulary of racism was terms like structural and systemic and institutional racism. And for me, I found so many people asking me, and these were everyday people, you know, in churches and community centers and bookstores, you know, asking, okay, what do you mean when you say institutional racism, when you say structural racism? Like, break that down, brother. Mm-hmm. And I typically did not have a response, or my response increasingly became basically racist policies. And typically when I would speak about racist policies, it would be something that people could more easily understand. And so for me, obviously, we're having, and we've been having in this country for a very long time, arguments and discussions and debates over race and racism. And for me, I think that the more exacting terms we use, the better for our discussion.
One of the other terms that you dismiss is the term microaggression. You note that it was coined by a Harvard psychiatrist, a guy named Chester Pierce, back in 1970, and you say you don't use that term anymore. How come?
Well, I think two different reasons. First and foremost, that the term actually became popular during the Obama era, or I should more so say the post-racial era that sort of emerged during the Obama era, in which obviously racism was persisting and impacting people, but less and less people were willing to use what I call the R word, racism, because mm-hmm. they had reduced it back to what we talked about earlier as almost like a slur. And so other terms like microaggressions, even though it was an older term, it sort of emerged in popularity. And then secondly, the reason why I don't sort of use that term is because I wanted to use a term that's really spoke to the effects of microaggression. So what happens when, you know, you walk out of a store and after being followed in that store and you try to hail a cab and that cab doesn't get you and you walk down the street to your home and a police officer looks at you funny? What happens when these things are constantly happening to you because you're Black? Well, it almost becomes a form of abuse. And so that's why I call it racist abuse.
And they aren't the same thing then, right? Because if they were the same thing, it wouldn't matter if you use them interchangeably. But a microaggression, I just want to make sure I understand this completely. A microaggression stops at the point where the racism is manifest and doesn't go past that point to where the effects of it and the consequences of it are clear.
Do I have precisely that? Yeah. And also typically, like abuse, microaggressions are regular and constant.
Yeah. And the term institutional racism, you note that it was termed or coined back in 1967. It was a long time ago, by a Black Power activist, Kwame Ture, and a political scientist named Charles Hamilton. They wrote a book called Black Power, The Politics of Liberation in America. As you've studied the evolution of racist ideas, have you found that they have changed, that they continue to evolve and change, that it's constantly in a state of flux? Is our notion of racism considerably different now in the age of Trump than it was in the age of Obama or even in the age of George W. Bush or Bill Clinton?
I think in certain profound ways it has changed, but then in certain profound ways it's remained the same. So to give an example, to compare the Obama era with the Trump era, you had many Americans who were claiming, who are saying, I'm not racist because I voted for Barack Obama. And then now you have many Americans saying, I'm not racist because I oppose Trump. And so in a way, these two, you know, powerful figures became a sort of symbol to allow people to claim how they're not racist, because that's what Americans want to claim, really, you know, that they're not racist. And that's one of the reasons why I talk about that the heartbeat of racism itself is denial, that this is a consistent, powerful thing that people want to do, while the heartbeat of anti-racism is confession.
And you also observe that the only way that white power can gain full control is to convince African Americans that whites have all the power. But isn't there a pretty good argument that, you know, the white establishment, in fact, yields most of the power? I mean, how do you recognize your power as an African American person in the context of the, I can't come up with any other term than systemic, you know, use of the white establishment?
That's why I think I wanted, I think it was critically important for me in the book to talk about power and to define power. And I actually talked about power as having three different levels. And so you have policymakers, and that is really the most powerful people in society are policymakers. And without question, white people predominate in policymaking positions, but they're not all of the people in policymaking positions. And then you have policy managers. These are the people who execute policies that have been made by others, typically above them, you know, on the sort of institutional ladder. And Black people are more likely to be in policy managing positions than policy making. And you have Black people who are in those positions who are refusing to carry out racist policies, which demonstrates their power as a manager to refuse to carry that out. And then the other level of power is the power to resist. And I think we oftentimes forget how crucially it is for us to remember that each and every one of us has the power to resist those policy managers, the power to resist those policies makers, the power to resist those racist policies. And once we forget that we have that power, of course, we're not going to resist, which then means that racism will persist and be guaranteed.
But that's public policy, the power that lies in public policy. You know, it's a governmental thing. It's a matter of statute. It's a matter of enforcement of the statutes. It's a matter of abuse of the enforcement of various statutes. What about, you know, the white woman who goes into a community pool and starts harassing and insisting that, you know, Black swimmers leave because they don't belong there? That's not a matter of governmental policy. That municipality doesn't have that on the books of, in their laws, and it's certainly not a matter of federal law. How is that a system? Is that a circumstance of power imbalance as well, or what is that?
So I'm glad you asked that, because when I defined policy as a term in How to Be an Anti-Racist, I didn't actually just define it as sort of these formal public policies that are in statute books. There are informal, unwritten policies. And so, for instance, it was never written in Albany, Georgia, that when a white person was walking down the street, that a Black person had to essentially move out of their way. But if that Black person did not, there was a historic memory of what happens to you if you don't follow through with that unwritten policy. In the case of a white woman going into a pool and harassing Black people, depending on the type of environment. And so if this is, for instance, a majority white pool where local officials are white and racist, then, and that Black person recognizes that, then obviously those local policies and policymakers are going to basically substantiate her behavior, even though that policy isn't necessarily written. And this is why it becomes very, very complex to really, when we think about it at an interpersonal level.
Dr. Ibram X. Kendi is my guest. We're talking about his latest book, How to Be an Anti-Racist. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. 410-662-8780 is our phone number, our email, midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us @midday WYPR. Dr. Kendi, we have an email from Chris who says, I finished Stamp from the Beginning last night. That's the book you published before this one. And I've started reading How to Be an Anti-Racist this morning. I thought Stamp from the Beginning to be one of the most important books I've read in many years on race or any other topic. And I expect to go back over it again and again as I hope to continue on my own path to being an anti-racist. As a civil rights lawyer who's focused for years on issues affecting individuals with disabilities, I want to think long and hard about how what you have to say may apply in that context as well. And you do write about space racism, gender racism, sexuality racism. What are the connections in those instances?
Well, I think in terms of disability, for instance, when we look at the fact that not only are Black people mass incarcerated in this country, but the people who are most, in many cases, highly likely to be incarcerated are people who suffer from a mental disability. And so instead of treating those people, instead they're incarcerated. And part of the reason why that happens for Black people is because a mental disability is reduced to their Blackness, as opposed to having a clinical condition. And this is something that's quite dear for me because my brother has a mental disability. And I've seen the ways in which people respond to him in ways that they don't respond to white people with mental disabilities. In other words, they chalk up his struggles, for instance, to communicate with his Blackness as opposed to his disability.
Ibram X. Kendi is a columnist at The Atlantic and the founding director of the Anti-Racist Research and Policy Center at American University in Washington. We're talking about his new book, How to Be an Anti-Racist. We'll have more with Dr. Kendi when we continue our program after a quick break. Again, our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. And you can tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. So before we go to a break, it is our practice each week here on Midday to read the names of people who have lost their lives to violence in Baltimore City. We do so to stand in witness to their untimely deaths, and we remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. So far this year, 227 people in Baltimore City have been victims of homicide. Police have released the identities of 21 of those folks whose deaths were first reported during the last 3 weeks of August. Shaunice Singletary was shot in 2012. She died last month as a result of complications from her injury, and her death has been ruled a homicide. She was 43 years old. The other victims are Kendrick Sharp, age 48, Dominique Edmonds, she was 32, Michael Woodtie, age 52, Karen Taylor, age 20, Keonti Barber, age 24, Devin Rogers, age 23, Charles Jeffries, age 39, Tyon Turman, age 17, Damian Carlton, age 37, Dominique Mitchell, age 28, Dominique Harvey, age 31, David Lane, age 20, Dayan Thomas, age 21, Sherman Reed Jr., age 31, Michael Beattie, age 47, Evan Brewington, age 19, Tyrin Brown, he was also 19, Kenneth Shellington, he was 24, Antonio Skipwith, age 17, and Yusef Adam, he was also 17 years old, Avery Rich, age 20, Terrence Withers, age 36, Ricardo James, age 20, Jermaine Stroud, age 27, Donald Jackson, age 27, Karen Lovings, age 51, and Milton Carrington. He was 16 years old. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking today with Dr. Ibram X. Kendi in his new book, How to Be an Anti-Racist. Dr. Kendi explores the modern interpretation of the word racism, and he examines how the manipulation and misunderstanding of that term has impeded our ability to redress the discriminatory policies that have shaped our culture. You are welcome to join our conversation at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, and to tweet us, it's @MiddayWYPR. So Dr. Kendi, we have a caller on the line who wants to talk about the connection between racism and classism, according to our screener. Before we get to that distinction, I want to talk a little bit about behavioral racism, which we touched on a little earlier in the program. At one point in your book, you write that you found it personally difficult to rise above your own behaviorally racist insecurity. We also hear, it's almost a trope, of people talking about personal responsibility. People from the far right of the political spectrum to even people like President Barack Obama, who was criticized in many circles for his comments in that regard during his presidency. How do you respond to that notion that, you know, this is all a matter of personal responsibility, and if people are behaving badly, the consequences that they're suffering because of that bad behavior have nothing to do with race, they have to do with how they're behaving?
Well, I would sort of contextualize that statement. And so to give an example, 40%, roughly 40% of the incarcerated population in this country is Black, even though Black people make up about 13% of the national population. So there's only two explanations for that massive racial disparity, meaning Black people should make up about 13% of the incarcerated population, but we make up 40%. There's only two explanations. Either it's the function of racist policy and ideas, or it's because Black people are behaving badly. And so those who can't fathom that they're criminal like Black people and they're criminal like white people, and no one has actually ever proven that Black people and Blackness and Black culture drives more crime. So they say that, you know what, Black people need to take personal responsibility. You are the reason why you're being mass incarcerated, why you're being racially profiled, why you're being killed by police. And then when we ask for evidence, because we have documented evidence that proves and shows the pervasiveness of racist policies and ideas within the criminal justice system, when we ask for similar evidence that show Black behavioral deficiency, they don't have it, because typically they use anecdotes, meaning an individual examples here and there to generalize Black behavior, which in fact is a racist idea.
When you talk about the notion of Black on Black crime, which is another instance that a lot of people raise in this conversation, how do you explain then the apparent difference in behavior? Here in our city, we have a real epidemic of violence and murder. I've just read the names of people who were killed just in the last 3 months or 3 weeks of last month. And the majority of those folks are people of color. If white people aren't killing each other to the same degree that in our city, at least, African Americans are, what do we make of that?
So I think it's actually quite easy to explain. When we look at the Black America more broadly, we find that Black neighborhoods do not have similar levels of violence. And if it was the case that there was something about Black people killing Black people, Black culture, Black irresponsibility, Black criminality, Black people were disproportionately predisposed to violence and crime, then no matter where Black people lived in concentration, you'd have similar levels of violent crime. But that doesn't actually exist. In other words, higher income Black neighborhoods have lower levels of violent crime than impoverished Black neighborhoods. And that's actually the case in white America, in Latinx America, Asian America, Native America. That's actually the case around the world. In other words, you have higher levels of poverty and long-term unemployment, you're going to have higher levels of violent crime. And so instead of us imagining that this is a problem of Blackness, we should be recognizing that it's a problem of poverty and unemployment. And be, you know, rectifying those problems.
And that's a really important point that you make, that, you know, there is a lot of data that says there's a much clearer correlation between violent crime and unemployment than there is a correlation between violent crime and race. But that idea has not taken off. I mean, people are not understanding this issue in those from that perspective. What will it take for that understanding to grab hold?
I actually think what it would take would for us to essentially change the policies. In other words, change the policies that would allow for the elimination of long-term and deep-seated poverty or disproportionate amounts of poverty in Black neighborhoods. And then that would then lead to lower levels of violent crime over time. And then those racial inequities and homicide rates would, of course, close. I just don't see Americans sort of looking out at these current disparities, seeing so many politicians sort of standing up on this idea that the real problem is Black on Black crime, and essentially recognizing the truth. Because this idea of the Black criminal, the violent Black criminal, is one of the oldest and most deep-seated racist ideas. In fact, in How to Be an Anti-Racist, I talk about the world's first racist. One of the terms he used to describe Black people was beast, right? The beast. And then a few centuries
later. And this goes way back. We're talking centuries ago, right?
Yeah, 1453. And then by the 1600s, Black people were called devils and demons. And now we're classified as criminals. And so this is a very deep-seated idea. And so I think in order for us to get rid of these ideas, we have to actually get rid of what is causing these ideas, and that's these disparities in the policies that are creating them.
The book's called How to Be an Anti-Racist. My guest is Ibram X. Kendi from American University in Washington. Dr. Kendi, let's go to the phones to Tom in Mount Vernon. Tom, you've been patient this afternoon. I appreciate it. What's your comment?
Mr. Vall, it's nice to speak to you. And also, I'd like to ask your guest, Dr. Kendi, if in his research, has he evaluated any relationship, if it exists, between racism and classism?
All right, thanks for that comment. Racism and classism, you do write about this, Dr. Kendi. What do you think?
Yes, I actually have a whole chapter, I think you would like, entitled Class, because I actually sort of talk about this relationship. And sort of to give you a little preview, you know, as an historian, I sort of track the history of racism. And that history of racism has largely intertwined the history of capitalism. And so they've historically reinforced each other from the beginning. And so that's why I sort of classify racism and capitalism as the conjoined twins. And in the chapter, I explain how and why.
Is it capitalism or is it the inequities in the various systems of housing and education and employment opportunity that cause the deleterious effects on African Americans? I mean, capitalism itself. I mean, are you contending that it's the system of capitalism that's the problem, and that should be abandoned? And if so, what should we replace it with?
So one of the interesting things about the discussion about capitalism is that it mirrors the discussion about racism. And you know, even in the chapter, I talk about how the way that capitalism is traditionally defined doesn't actually fit its historical and material reality. And so I think in order for me to answer that question that you just asked, I think we have to have a very real accounting of what capitalism is, just like we have to have a very real accounting of what racism is and the ways in which they've intersected and presumably intertwined, so we can really determine. And from my reading of the history of capitalism, the history of capitalism cannot be separated with the transatlantic slave trade, cannot be separated from colonialism, cannot be separated from slavery, cannot be separated from the fact that by 2030, people are estimating that 90% of extremely poor people in this world will live in sub-Saharan Africa. So these are things in which that's my reading of it based on sort of its principles and its history, but there could be another reading. And I think we have to have a very real accounting of what capitalism and also racism truly is.
You have a chapter about space racism, gentrification in neighborhoods that at one time were, you know, economically impoverished and that have risen out of that, at least if real estate values are to be believed. Is that the same kind of thing? When you talk about space racism, is gentrification part of that discussion?
So the way that it relates, it can relate to that discussion, is when you take the same neighborhood that 5 years ago was majority Black, and today it's majority white. And people 5 years ago saw that neighborhood as dangerous, as undesirable, as ugly. And now they see that neighborhood as beautiful, as desirous, as safe, right? That is a reflection that what people do is they look at spaces, they say that space is Black, so it must be inferior, it must be dangerous, it must be impoverished when in relation to this white space. And that's a function of what I talk about as space racism, that we don't just view particular races as superior and inferior, we also view racialized spaces as inferior and superior as well.
We have a couple minutes left, and we talked earlier in the program about at the core of this conversation about how to be an anti-racist. And at the end of the book, you have several steps that you outline to that end. Confession and the getting rid of the denial of racism is really at the core of it. You also say that you mentioned the word struggle in your list of, you know, 8 or 10 things here. I struggle to think with anti-racist ideas. This isn't easy, is it?
It isn't. And that's why I sort of talk about being racist. And I would argue we're in a way trained to be racist and nurtured and bred to be racist in this country. I sort of compare being racist with like an addiction, with like a personality characteristic that in our older age we decided, you know, we don't want to be that way anymore, you know, we don't want to be addicted to that substance anymore. And so in order to move away from that addiction, in order to be a different type of person and to move past that personality characteristic, it is an everyday process, it is an everyday struggle, it is something we have to constantly be conscious of and aware of in order to be anti-racist. And so I think that's why I called it a struggle, because it truly is.
And I want to commend you as well. I mean, as a scholar, it seems to me it'd be an interesting decision that you've made in this book, which is a very personal book. You talk about your battle with cancer that you've overcome, and we're delighted about that. You talk about moving around a lot, going to different schools as a little kid. You were the new kid at school, you know, for most of your early career before you went to college. We have a few seconds left. That decision to personalize this in so many ways, was that an interesting, what went into that?
Well, that was hard, because I, as a scholar, as you stated, I you know, have not been trained to sort of write and research on myself. So it was certainly hard. But racism, as you know, and race, these are deeply personal. And so I felt it would be more effective to write it in a personal way.
Dr. Ibram X. Kendi, the book is called How to Be an Anti-Racist. Dr. Kendi will be discussing his book at Shriver Hall on the campus of Johns Hopkins University tomorrow night with the political scientist and Hopkins professor, Dr. Lester Spence. He's a good buddy of this program. That event begins at 7 o'clock, and we've got information on our website, wipr.org/midday. Dr. Kendi, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on the show.
That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, an analysis of the dramatic changes in the Republican Party that led to Donald Trump's election and his enduring and solid popularity among Republicans. My guest will be Tim Alberta, the chief political correspondent at Politico. We'll talk about his really interesting book, American Carnage, on the Front Lines of the Republican Civil War and the Rise of President Trump. That's coming up tomorrow on Midday. We want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared has been recently recognized by the Daily Meal. Menu and hours are available at joesquared.com. I'm Tom Hall. Here and Now is up next after the news at the top of the hour. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.